Why, hello and welcome. Welcome to the Peer Pressure Podcast. I am Diane, sometimes known as Diane Kamikaze, and I am your host. The reason why I do this podcast is because I like to say I am a champion of heavy music. I've always found my favorite songs since I was a young kid had riffs, hooks, were either metal, hardcore, hard rock, or punk, or something fairly aggressive in attitude and sound. And I am all about appreciating the people that keep that world going, whether they're musicians, webmasters, other podcasters, record label and festival owners. It's important to me to recognize what these people do in that realm of music. So, I am here to bring them to you in a different context, more than a Wikipedia entry or a press release, a little more personal and a lot more fun. I'm a rocker for life, and I hope these episodes do make a difference. Send me feedback at diane@wfmu.org, and my Facebook page is Diane Kamikaze Farris, Rocker for Life. Like my page there, and I will keep everybody updated on podcast episodes in that space. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned. Today's guest is Spit Styx, known by some as Tim Leach, drummer of Fear and of Portland band Nasal Rod, currently. We will talk to him about the legendary performance of Fear on Saturday Night Live, find out who calls him Spitty, and some background on the Decline of Western Civilization movie, among other things.
Right. I hear you this time.
Thank you. Spit, shall I call you Spit or shall I call you Tim?
You can call me Tim.
All right, Tim.
I have friends who still call me Spit or Spitty or Spitto, but most people know me as Tim these days.
And how did the name Spit come about? Were you a spitter?
Not at all. I was Californian, heavy into barbecuing. It was the other kind of spit. Actually, that's not true. My brother and I, our roommate, parents lived in England, and he came back in 1976 with a fresh Sex Pistol record.
Ooh.
And I was totally into jazz, into fusion, into international. I was into Saudi Arabian music, actually, at the time. And kind of lost interest with rock. Kind of it slowed down with Pink Floyd and things. It just seemed to be so sleepy. So the Sex Pistols album woke me up, and it was funny, and it inspired me. So my brother and I were going to form a band called Spit, and it never came to pass. But when I joined Fear, with Durf having a name like Durf Scratch and leaving, I couldn't really be Timmy Leach, even though that's kind of cool, but I couldn't really leave that. So Spit kind of came to mind, and it kind of sounds like a hi-hat, hitting a hi-hat, Spit Styx. It was a very percussive sound. And my uncle had a company called Gone Bops. He made congas, and that was kind of a percussive-y kind of sound. So I thought, Spit Styx. It kind of sounds like a hi-hat and a snare hit. That's where that came from.
Oh, neat.
But so also, it's funny because when I work with Nina Hagen, I remember being in an Autobahn walking, getting something to eat with her, and she puts her arm around me and calls me Spitty. Okay, well, I tried to get rid of that little IE, but it keeps creeping back.
That definitely changes the context of a tough...
Minimizes it a little bit.
Yeah, of a punk name when you add the little IE to it. That's cute, though. I can see.
A little too cute, but I don't care. It's all good.
I can see her doing that. So, thank you for coming on the show. And
of course.
You are so accomplished, and there's so much with you, and I'm already afraid that we're going to run out of time. Now, I'd like to just sort of have you chronicle a little bit, and Spit has a really cool website out there. I believe it's called Punk Chronicle.
Yeah, you can find it under just, you punch in Spit Styx and Punk Rock Chronicle. As a side, I did kind of like a blow-by-blow kind of my time with Fear, just to take some of the iffiness. Some people weren't quite sure, rumors of this and that.
It's great, and it's a quick, but it's really sort of like bulleted items about Fear in a way. And if I may, I'd like to just read the little introduction that's on the site. It says, Spit Styx, a punk chronicle, Spit's time with Fear, 1978 to 1993. Going to a Fear show always guaranteed a show by the audience. Plenty of people thought our stage rantings were serious. Dead Kennedys thought we were fascists. Homophobes thought we were gay. Lesbians thought we were misogynists. Entertainment is a form of employment. We were just working hard.
It's funny, the Dead Kennedys, we've played San Francisco quite a bit, up Mobuhead Gardens and on Broadway, and done shows with them. But they took us seriously and didn't like the fact that when you visit San Francisco a lot, the tourists call it Frisco. And, of course, the natives hate that, and they correct you constantly. So just liking to rile people up in the audience, Lee would say, yeah, we're a local band. We're from Frisco. We're gay. So going back to Los Angeles, hearing people online that didn't know that I was eavesdropping on them would say that. They're from Frisco, and they're gay. So both things were wrong, but it was hilarious. It was just this great, you know, buzz on the, at street level that people were getting wrong, but it was just exactly what we wanted, that misinformation out there that kind of got people in conversation with each other, correcting each other.
And because you're observing what happened and how you sort of put yourselves in there, would you say that there was a message or a focus for Fear in terms of how you approached every show? Or
I think, well, I wasn't a front man. I think as an entertainer and a musician, I tried to kind of raise the musical bar. I tried to play more musical drums than just oompa, fast.
Oh, you did.
And being from a musical family, I just tried to bring that musical influence in. I'd been playing fusion and some stuff that wasn't so straight, and I tried to bring that influence into Fear myself. So speaking for myself, I know that Philo is very much a mathematician. He's got a degree in physics, and so he thinks very mathematically. So he brought in kind of some mathy elements in himself. So between he and I, putting those elements into something kind of palatable, Lee put the icing on it with kind of a Don Rickles approach, which was just the opposite of so many bands that I love. You know, bands we'd play with X, and John would say, thank us, everyone, for coming out. Really love you guys and really appreciate blah, blah, blah. So our message, you know, was, you know, fuck you all. Or, excuse me for the beep there. The message was just the opposite. It was more the Don Rickles approach of I'm sorry you guys came here tonight. You should go home and cut your hair. So it was... It was reverse psychology, you know, in the extreme, and it worked really well because people did cut their hairs and they came back and they started seeing that it was tongue-in-cheek. And even Bob Biggs from Slash, who signed us eventually, saw that it was tongue-in-cheek, saw that it was kind of Don Rickles. And Lee had told me he had seen Little Richard in the 50s play to like a sellout house and everyone was dressed to the nines and jammed up against the stage, you know, with their nice gowns and suits, and Little Richard finally comes on after a long evening, and with all this crowd and the crowd smushing up against the stage, he pulls a can of Right Guard out and tells everyone in the audience they stink and proceeds to spray the whole front row with Right Guard.
Wow.
So Lee loved that kind of irreverence and kind of brought that with his reverse psychology, and he's kind of a tough guy anyways. He's Irish-Italian, so he's got hot blood. So it's very easy for him to fall into that role. So Philo balanced that, and even Durf balanced that kind of with the extreme yin on the other end of Lee's yang, just to keep it in balance. Philo would act totally wimpy, as extremely wimpy as he could, against Lee's extreme macho. And it was funny. It was a good balance when the humor against the aggro delivery of the music was something that wasn't all one way or the other. There was an interesting balance.
Was that how it was off stage also, like in rehearsal and that kind of thing?
No, off stage, I think it was very, very much a creative, funny atmosphere off stage. We all got along really well and enjoyed each other's company, and it wasn't like that at all. However, Lee, very much being a band leader, would bring songs in that were finished and say, here's the song, let's do it. And so there wasn't a lot of cooperation in songwriting. As much as Lee brought stuff in, stuff did get written, though, at rehearsals. And a lot of times I'd get to rehearsal ahead of time and warm up, and Durf would just start playing a bass line through my warm-ups, like song Fresh Flesh is exactly that. Mm. It's just one of my warm-ups that Durf started playing a bass line to, and it became a song. And songs like I Don't Care About You is an exercise. Let's Have a War. Philo kind of pushed me into that beat, but it's basically an exercise of my just warming up before I play, so
oh,
I can
really
play at mock speed when the song starts. So a lot of that stuff is based out of some of my exercises, but for the most part, Lee would bring songs, finished songs in.
That's really interesting, because in some ways, it's like, I think that the vocals and the drumming is the most important part of Fear. And to say that some of these were actually started off as drum exercises is not really a surprise, but it's really cool. And you know, we did just play Let's Have a War, I think, we Destroy the Family in the last set, and just...
That's very much an exercise.
Yeah.
It's an exercise in 10-8. It's basically a single-stroke roll exercise, you know, put to the drum kit. And it's one that I teach. I teach drums now. One of my advanced students, I've taught that exact exercise to.
Oh, really?
Basically a single-stroke roll exercise in 5.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes from my drum and bugle corps days. When I was like 12, I joined a private drum and bugle corps, the Royal Cavaliers in Los Angeles, and that kicked my butt, and it forged me into something that I wasn't before, and I still use those exercises to warm up.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Dale had called me in 95, and I hadn't played in 2 years when I quit Fear. I was totally bummed out because I put like 15 years, and I was really upset about that band not going the direction that had been going for so long. And so I just stopped playing drums. I got into studying digital audio and some other things. And Dick Dale called me, and he says, I've got a tour. Pulp Fiction was out, and he wanted a tour the East Coast, and he wanted me to play drums for him. One of my buddies was playing bass with him, and he'd heard of me through the grapevine. So he called me and says, I got 40 songs for you to learn. I'll be out there in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So I just went to rehearsal studio for a couple hours a day and practiced my exercises, the same ones I teach now. It brought me totally back up to speed, and I was ready 2 weeks later. So the exercises that I've used since I was 12, I still use.
The drum and bugle corps background.
Hey, I climbed a drum kit, not just one drum, but they are evergreen.
Wait, say that again?
They're timeless. Those exercises just work forever.
Yeah. Were you playing rock when you joined Fear?
I wasn't really. When I first joined Fear, I was into reggae. I was into some African music. A friend of mine, CC Smith, ran the Beat magazine, Reggae Beat magazine. So I was really into African music and stuff that was more challenging for me rhythmically. As you know, I've been playing since I was 8. So
wow.
By the time I was 22 when I joined Fear, rock music was like my left hand would fall asleep, you know, wasn't doing anything. So I really got into music that was a little more challenging. I was looking at people like Tony Williams and Billy Cobham and some drummers that were more challenging rhythmically, keeping me on the edge of my seat. So when I joined Fear, it was challenging. It was fast, and I broke a sweat, and these guys were athletes. So I felt I was with people that were working at my own pace, and it was rock. And because I like punk from the Sex Pistols, I got the humor, and I love that aggro balance with humor. And so I fell right into it. And of course, I could play it right away. It's just my approach to it was not such a rock approach, even though I'd played rock forever. I tried to bring something a little more different into it. But I liked the intensity. Drummers that I'd seen, like Carla from the Controllers, Carla Mad Dog,
mm-hmm.
really pushed it. The drummer from the Vibrators, British band, also just played right up on the beat. And so I noticed a few drummers that were out there that were playing up there. I'd gone to see the Ramones at the Whiskey in L.A., and I remember they stopped one song, and it was 2, 3, 4, boom, right into the next song. And people on the dance floor were exhausted. I just loved it. I was, of course, on the dance floor, totally drenched in sweat and exhausted myself. So with Fear, I was really excited to stop one song, and Lee would just, what did he, boom, right into the next song. It was like, yes, this is what I love.
Yeah.
Loved out in the audience, so I loved playing it because I could do it. I was a runner. I still am a runner. So I love the cardiovascular part of that. And Fear was very much an athletic band and pushed other bands. I think that became a thing amongst, at least in LA punk bands that I was aware of, it kind of been, we kept the rung high with faster and faster. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, we can do, you know, faster and faster. So that was a fun part of it for me. Just being a drummer, of course, is very athletic. But then punk was at the end of my gas pedal, which I love, and I still love doing it. I still love playing fast. Nasal Rod has some really fast stuff and shows I'm drenched, and playing drum and bass live for a while in New York City while I lived there was the same thing. It was everything's 180 BPM.
Oh, yeah.
And you're at the end of your brain's ability and your body's ability, which I love being there.
I do need to ask you about sort of two big things in Fear's history, because the listeners would just totally freak out if I didn't. Halloween 1981, the legendary Saturday Night Live appearance.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Zerf was teaching Tino Insana, bass player, he was teaching him bass. And Tino's from Chicago, Second City comedian alumni, and had hung as buddies with John Belushi. And Belushi had seen New Wave Theater. Peter Ivers hosted this show. David Joe, producer, was pre-MTV in Los Angeles and cable TV around the country. That David Joe would have bands in a circle, and he'd just film a couple songs and move the cameras to the next little quadrant and move around the hub filming bands. And it was there that John had seen us perform, and we did a mock up. Peter Ivers, the host, was an awesome person, very androgynous and gay on looking on camera. However, he's a black belt in karate and very smart. He'd done the soundtrack to Eraserhead. Very, very, very awesome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but because his stage persona was so gay, it just left us open to, like, not leave it alone. And we did a mock beat-up of him. And, of course, he could have kicked all of our asses, but he went along with us knowing we were kidding. And it looked great on camera to John because, you know, this is Peter was the guy you loved to hate kind of at the time. And then John saw us in the decline of Western civilization, and that kind of was the cincher. And he found out through Tino that Tino knew Durf, the bass player, and he got our phone numbers from Durf. And Durf wasn't available at that particular moment. And he called Lee and I and invited us to the place above the Roxy on the Rocks in Los Angeles just for some beers. He wanted to meet us. So, of course, we jumped on it. And within a few minutes of meeting him at this place, this fancy private club, I walk in, Jack Nicholson is sitting there and Tatum O'Neill.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, I guess I'm somewhere special. And John just knew all of our jokes. He immediately says, hey, I'll give you a dollar if you'll be my friend. And so he knew all our shtick, and I apologize because I didn't even have a TV at the time. But I didn't really know his stuff, but he overlooked that. And by the end of our hangout, he says, you got to do Saturday Night Live. And I thought, okay, I just had 16 beers, and my adrenaline's going, and I didn't even feel him. And I thought, okay, this guy's, I've never met this guy in my life. He's telling me I'm going to be on Saturday Night Live. And so I didn't believe him. I went home, and I puked. And I figured I'd never see him, hear from him. And like 2 weeks later, guy Eric from Rockefeller Center, this is Eric from Rockefeller Center, what kind of set do you want built? And I thought, what is Rockefeller Center? And he goes, well, for your Saturday Night Live show. And I said, I guess an alley or something. That's what I told him.
Okay.
And I hang up, and I was like, I realized, hey, we're going to do Saturday Night Live. So that's how I was told about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the irony of that is John had asked the Circle Jerks and the Go-Go's to do it before he even asked Fear, and both of those bands dissed him.
Wow.
I'm sure the Circle Jerks just didn't return his calls, and the Go-Go's probably figured, okay, here's a chubby boy, you know, macking us. But he actually told me that he had asked them and was brokenhearted that they didn't even return his calls. So, you know, we weren't the first that he wanted to get on that show, but we actually made it, even though we weren't signed, technically. And he loved the fact that it's kind of shook up the house there, and so much so that the cable or the union people got really upset when we actually showed up and were really upset because 1981, of course, people really thought punks were kind of like Clockwork Orange and it's the end of the world or something. They didn't realize, you know, that there were some nice people in those punk costumes.
Oh, yeah, there was absolute fear attached to the stigma of punk, for sure.
But the word fear put on it, you know, people were intimidated.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy was saying, what the F is going on here, you know, get this, you know, out of here. He was very upset.
And wow.
Other people were cool, like Tim Kazurinski. Other people on the crew got the joke, and they knew that we were not going to kill them. But a lot of people were upset, and the union people complained when someone tripped over a cable. And John went up to Grant Tinker's office and said, look, we want the dancers, he called them, who's, you know, a lot of very cool people were in that group. But he says, we want the dancers. They're part of the show. So Grant Tinker says, okay, you know, if you intro the show, people think you're actually on the show. I'll do it. So that was John's agreement. John opens the show at a urinal talking to someone, and he turns around and, you know, it says live from Saturday Night from New York City, you know, and introduces the show. It was a trade-off to please the Grant Tinker to appease the union people who were upset. And then when a pumpkin got thrown at a monitor and someone had to clean it, they claimed we did like $250,000 damage. That's what I saw. But actually, someone said there was a lot of hair from haircuts and spit and some other things in the green room. And the riot police escorted all those people out, which I didn't even see. Going to and from stage, we were escorted with red carpet and people, James Taylor, a lot of people hanging around, giving us props. And So we didn't see any of that business. We just heard about it later, and of course our name was Mud for a while on decent clubs. They believed that we'd just come in and gut their club if we played there. So
really? I mean, there was a certain street cred that you got for sort of breaking that barrier and somehow getting yourselves on TV and bringing a whole bunch of punks, I mean, New York punks and D.C. punks onto the show.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that was but
I think John had a love of blues. Like, you know, he met Curtis Zogato here in Portland at Eugene, and that's how the whole Blues Brother thing came. Lee has a lot of blues influence himself, so it was just John's love of blues, and John being a wannabe Buddy Miles. You know, when I would jam with John, he would sit at the drums, and he was just in seventh heaven. He just loved playing drums and singing. You know, he wishes he was Buddy Miles.
Wow.
And so it was John's love of blues, really, that he saw that element in Fear. And he, of course, he saw the humor, and he saw the musicianship, and wanted to bring that to the public. So John just being a good steward for music that he loved, because he wanted it. He was like a musician trapped in an actor's body, is what he told me. But he loved it. He and I would hang out. I was producing his album and of course, stuff for the movie Neighbors. And he was paying me $500 a day. This was in 1981, 82,
wow.
You know, to produce his stuff. So he's a very, very generous cat. And then, we go get a bite to eat, and we drive by what's now the Viper Room. We drive by the Central, and we remember walking in, and the band just, their mouths drop, and I just sit on the drums, and John grabs a mic, and we're doing Fire, Jimi Hendrix, you know. We finish the song, and we walk out, you know. It's just fun. And he would just do the funniest things. I'd sit on his lap, and he goes, "Put your hands behind your back." And I'd sit on his lap, and he'd be my arms and my voice, make me look like an idiot. That kind of stuff, just spontaneous. But just a humble cat. I just really miss him. This awesome, generous cat. And Bob Woodward called me and said, you know, "Tell me about his cocaine use." I'm like, come on, dude. This is my friend, really? John was at the Starwood, and someone smooshed a hamburger into his face, you know, and then he had to get a bodyguard. So, he really was misunderstood in a lot of ways, but
yeah.
A generous, nice cat, and I just, that's why really Fear got on Saturday Night Live. He pursued, he did his homework, finding out who we were, what our phone numbers were, talking to us, and then meeting with us, and he really made it all happen.
It sounds like he really appreciated the scene and wanted it to get a little bit more exposure.
He did,
yeah.
And he saw it. The fact he was aware of the Go-Go's and the Circle Jerks, he knew it was going on. He saw this awesome thing bubbling out of this, you know, dying rock that was fresh and, you know, full of life and just blooming out of the middle of this Uriah Heep and all this other music that was just dinosaur, and the leftover 50s and 60s saccharine Carpenters and all
right.
This horrible stuff that was forced on the airwaves. You know, finally it's like something was relieving, you know, people with their head screwed on straight with something fresh and something alive and with an attitude. So I think he saw that and really embraced it.
Oh, and he was in a position to be able to do something, and he did. You know,
he did.
Which is,
but he
which
wanted
is
to be
great.
A part of it, too. It's like we jam, and
yeah.
Lee was, we were doing a soundtrack for the movie Neighbors, and Lee was vocal coaching him. And there's Lee, or John, singing lead vocals, you know, with Fear behind him.
Wow.
So he loved it so much he wanted to do it. So, but John really, I mean, he had a band with his wife, Judy, and he was just, he loved being a musician and jamming that part of it as well. And, you know, but people get in their gigs and get seen for one thing, you know, and so he wasn't really accepted as a musician, but he brought all these other musicians to light through the Blues Brothers or even us on Saturday Night Live.
Wow. A lot of insights on John Belushi. Thanks for that.
Yeah. He's awesome.
I guess you had said that you produced the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, Flea was in Fear, and Flea and my songs weren't being performed. We'd rehearse Flea and my songs, but come to the show, Lee would do the set list, and then it's like, hey, where are our songs? So I was really frustrated, and Flea was too. And when Flea started jamming with his roommate, Anthony at the time, and a couple of their high school buddies, Hillel and Jack, they started doing all of Flea's songs, of course, and Flea had a really good outlet for all his material. And I'd hang out with them at rehearsals, and hang out with Flea and Anthony, other places, China Club, would just hang out with them. So I was aware of their band forming. And then when they started doing shows, I'd just show up to support them. I'd have the night off. I'd do their sound and lights at the same time. And I was producing a reggae artist called Boo Berry at the time, and was in this studio, Studio 9 on Hollywood and Western. It was like $20 an hour for a 2-inch, which is pretty cheap, and I could get in there and block a day out even for less. So I told him about it, and he decided to do it, and I said, let's record, you know, this band. So we did, and I tried to get him as much as first takes as I could, just having my own experience, knowing the first takes are the best, and you start thinking about it too much after that. Mm. I had him play songs other than the songs they were going to record just to get sounds, and then I cut a bunch of songs with them and mixed it over a period of a week or two, and that ended up getting them a deal on EMI, and I was thrilled. They ended up, label assigned them a producer, of course, and later on, when they left EMI, they were using George Clinton's studio, and I produced some more demos for them that I got their deal on Warner Brothers. Those recordings, a lot of people like Keith Forsyth and other producers say it was their best recordings, those early recordings, and I loved them because they were very funky. Hillel was like, you know, Jimi Hendrix from the Middle East with like a funk, you know, edge. Mm. And Jack is very musical on the drums, just very creative, you know, not kind of like myself, all over the toms and not just kick snare hat. And Flea, of course, is a machine on the bass. And Anthony had so much to say and was just really clever in his rhythms, just, you know, not just a square rhymer, ducka 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 da. You know, he's very, very clever, you know, with throwing, you know, Busta Rhyme kind of rhythms together. So I really liked that early formula. They ended up going kind of more in a rock direction because that's really what Flea liked doing. And when, without Hillel there to kind of focus it kind of more international and funky stuff, they kind of went a different direction. But whatever it's worth, they ended up just fine.
Did you think that they would last or become as popular as they did?
I love them. I did, and I always hope that for bands. When I see them, I'm always disappointed the public doesn't catch up to some bands because I loved them. I just was so excited about them, and I thought they were so funny and so original and so energetic that I always hope, but it's like happened many times where bands like here, there was a band here in town called the Mint Chicks, these four guys from New Zealand that were brilliant. You know, two brothers doing vocals, unison stuff, breaking into harmonies. One of the brothers playing guitar, one of them playing keyboards, drummer, really original stuff. And they were just misfocused, and I thought they were brilliant, and they didn't go anywhere. So it's always my hopes, and it was always my hope that Chili Peppers took off, and fortunately they did. It took them a few records, but they did take off, and I'm glad about that.
The other sort of big thing that I think I should probably get out of the way in terms of asking you would be about the decline of Western civilization. Like, how did that come about? How did you meet Penelope Spheres?
Well, Lee and I were, before every show, we would blast with posters Los Angeles, and one of our favorite spots was this spot between the valley and Hollywood, Laurel Canyon. There's a lot of people came and went from work there. So, of course, it's totally illegal to put up these posters, but so guerrilla style, we'd be putting these posters up, and I'm sure the neighbors complained. It's like, because it's not like you go back and collect your posters after the shows are over, so kind of a litter source for the neighbors who didn't care for that. But we were really good at promoting ourselves, and Lee and I were blasting posters, stapling them, one looking out for cops and the other, you know, stapling up the poster, and this car pulled up, and we thought it was another one of these neighbors just screaming at us, as often happens, and it was Penelope, and she was actually giving us props, and we sort of looked at her with, is this a trick? Are you calling the police? Or the police, you know, it's like, so, you know, she turned out she liked us, and she thought we were cool, and she liked the fact that especially our posters weren't your typical, you know, promoters' posters. They were hand-designed, or they're really designed by us. And so she took us in and said, you know, I'm going to be doing this documentary. And my girlfriend at the time was booking some venues that weren't venues. She was in real estate, so she found this bowling alley, ex-bowling alley, called the Arena, and turned it into a venue for a couple of shows. And one of those venues, Penelope, actually filmed. So she put up these giant posters, you're going to be filmed, and put separators for the crew and film the show, and of course it was a good show. I remember Penelope was on one side of this white paper they had divided for the crew, and I heard her say, you know, Spit's really smart. I thought that was weird. I thought, somebody thinks I'm stupid. She's got to correct them. I just remember that night, and there was But people kind of like amped it up just because of the cameras. And this probably like 6-foot by 4-foot sign was there, very obvious and very huge letters that you're going to be filmed. So it like really turned the volume up on people's, you know, audience participation.
Oh, sure.
Because
yeah.
they knew they were being filmed and there were cameras all over the place. And they weren't little wimpy cameras. These were high-end, serious cameras. And obviously a crew there and everything. So it was a great setting for that recording, that filming of that show.
So once the film came out, how did it affect the band?
Really well. We were kings in a sense. I remember the premiere for that show, I just shaved my head because my girlfriend talked me into dyeing it with henna, saying it would wash out. My hair was orange, and then she says, "Oh, just put this blue in there, and it'll make it turn black." And of course, then it turned purple. And I was a security guard. It was my day gig for movie sets. I was working for Dukes of Hazzard, watching the parking lot, so I couldn't really have purple hair. So I was at a Marine base, and they cut it all off first into a purple mohawk, which kind of looked cool for a minute. But then I said, "You know, I got a serious gig," so I cut it all off, and now the skinheads thought I was really cool. And I was like, really? I just did this to get rid of the purple hair. But that premiere, of course, makes us look great. She totally showcased us in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It made us look bigger than life, and of course, helped us. And Bob Biggs was her husband at the time, and he ran Slash Magazine and Slash Records. So having been on the Slash soundtrack for the movie, and then we did Saturday Night Live as a shoe-in that we got signed. So we ended up signing Slash, I think, in December or January of 82, immediately after that October 81 Saturday Night Live. And then we ended up touring in February. We started touring internationally, at least, in 82. So it kind of gave us street creds that we had to a certain extent, but kind of took us over the top. It kind of put us up on a pedestal that we weren't, you know, putting us in that film was like, okay, you guys are now, you know, punk icons. So it did raise our credibility. And then being signed and having label support, our guarantees went up pretty considerably. You know, in the early days, Fear was like getting, you know, $6 a man at shows. You know,
right. Whereas
after that, you know, it was considerably more.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Saturday Night Live and The Decline were both, and done well, like not in a cheesy way, not you know, done with the right intention from the start, like the way you talk about Penelope and the way you talk about John Belushi, like they both had, they wanted the story out there and they did it for the right reasons.
And it was time, I think. It was just time. I think punk had been around since in Los Angeles. My eyes noticed it like since 77, and I was interested in it from 76, but I actually started seeing it appearing in Los Angeles by 77, and it was still kind of looked at, you know, people were afraid of it, and I think that's the name Fear. The band came out of what was happening at the time, Hillside Strangler, Night Stalker. There were some serial murderers on the loose in that period of time. My girlfriend, you know, had a gun under her pillow. People were truly afraid. So it's kind of shake it up a little bit and kind of just overemphasize the fear, because there was fear. There was fear happening at the time. And Bob Seideman, a friend of Lee's, was a well-known rock photographer, 60s rock photographer, kind of came up with that name, Fear, and thought it would be good. It was fitting for the time. So the late 70s was kind of the birth of those punks appearing, at least for my eyes, in 77. In Los Angeles. And so by 81, you know, the mosh pit was born, and finally it was, you know, the monster was loose. You know, it finally come to full fruition, and it was really bringing people in that otherwise wouldn't have been brought in, that maybe thought it was some fringe thing, it was some underground thing, and they didn't understand it. It was for weird, geeky people or something. Then it started bringing in the general public. So 81 was kind of the birth of the mosh pit that I saw, because before that it was kind of like pogoing and hanging out with your friends and drinking beers and bashing into each other with people you knew. And then 81, it became a real pit, you know, total strangers, you mm-hmm. know, circling and, you know, doing some damage. So it really had come to life. And then, of course, then it kept growing.
Must have been an amazing time on the West Coast.
It was. I thought musically it was brilliant. I was so starved for something new. And those bands that I listened to, like the Dills, like the Deadbeats, Controllers, Weirdos, Screamers, that were, like, compared to what was being played and what other clubs were having play live, it was almost irreverent. But it was funny. It was fast. It was funny, and the people doing it. It was like Tomato DuPlenty, you know, would, from the Screamers, would put on this, you know, intense show, like Lee, you know. It's like, you know, this onslaught of vocals that no one else was doing that I saw at the time. And then, of course, you meet him, and he had the softest handshake. I think he probably was gay, but he was a super nice cat. It's super easygoing, just the sweetest guy. And other bands were doing the same thing. Other bands were kind of not taking the direction that pop music, you know, kind of this mechanical, manufactured, you know, repetitive dinosaur sound that had gone there. Los Angeles was alive and fertile with people that were saying, hey, I'm just doing what I want. You know, I can only play two chords, but dig this. I got something to say, you know. So, and bands like X, of course, were very high musicianship, and bands like Fear kind of used that as kind of a standard. And other bands, of course, like the Dills, Black Flag, those other bands that were also good musicians as well, that kept the musicianship high. It wasn't just about, I can play two chords and therefore I'm punk, and I can't sing, therefore I'm punk. There was that high musicianship inside of all this other kind of naive musicianship. So it was very fertile, and everything kind of inspired each other.
Well, I think that gives us a good jumping off point to go into your playlist. What do you think?
Yeah. Play, I don't know, you played Dills. I saw the Dills live right after I joined Fear, and they blew my mind. And they were playing Classical. I think it was at the Hollywood Palladium. I forget where it was exactly. Fleetwood or somewhere. No, I think it was in L.A., but they just blew my mind. Such good musicians and such high energy that it was, like, scary for me. It's like, God, these are my peers. I gotta practice, you know?
Well, and they were part of that whole Danger House thing, which was legendary. I mean,
Those records were great, and that label just, you know, it's just that the red and white stripes, you could spot them and know that, hey, this is probably going to be a good record.
Mm-hmm.
But they were actually getting airplay, and whereas very, very few other bands were getting airplay. So Danger House was doing something right. We thought KROQ took Fear bragging, you know, the people at KROQ to get on the playlist ourselves.
So. Did it really?
Danger House. Yeah, we had to bribe the station manager with some legal and illegal stuff, and suddenly we were on the playlist. And our label, Slash, was so pissed. They're like, you shouldn't have done that. And we're like, hey, it worked, and it worked in those days.
Well, there you go, and maybe the label need to see that.
Maybe Danger House did that, too. I don't know, but
yeah,
how we did it. We played, Fear played live on KROQ, too.
Oh, really?
Just a bottle of whiskey and some cute girls, but... So we had a little bit of history in there, but Danger House actually got airplay. I think it was probably on Rodney's show on Sundays, but that's one of the first things to play, because I give homage to those guys. There's a few bands that I saw that was like, holy crap, I gotta go home and sharpen my axe.
Well, it sounds like it was really a great sort of incubator for all of you, you know, because you're talking about a lot.
It just was like, because they packed the house, too. There were, like, tons of people in 78. This is, like, February 78, I think, when I first saw them. And they were packing the place. And for me, it was like, God, there's a scene already here. So there was. They had a following in early 78.
All right, so I think we're going to go and listen to the Dills. My guest is Tim Leach, sometimes known as Spit Sticks. And we're going to hear Class War from the Dills and a few other songs from his playlist. Please stay tuned.
I'm brainless.
And we have returned. My guest is Tim Leach, sometimes known as Spitsticks. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All righty. And let's just back announce those songs and give me a little blurb on why you played what you just played.
Well, Class War, all that stuff is like from 77, 78, Los Angeles. And it was the stuff that kind of like made me feel like I was in with kindred spirit. Like when I heard all that stuff, it was so fresh and irreverent and funny at the same time that it just was like, this is entertainment. This is art, you know. It's not trying to repeat something that's already been done. And like I was talking about Class War, that was a band that was established in 77. And when I saw them in 78, they already had a following. And it was like, oh, damn, I'm going into this. This is going to be my new peaks. And Black Flag, I became friends with Keith after he was asked to leave Black Flag. But I love Black Flag. They also set the bar high, as well as the Deadbeats were doing like jazz punk. It was like totally a combination of weird instruments. But this is all late 70s Los Angeles, which a lot of these bands, you know, Controllers, you played Slow Boy, was a band that I saw in Brendan Mullen's Mask on Hollywood and Cherokee. So much energy. Carla, Mad Dog, drummer, was one of those drummers that I just felt like, I want to be in your club. You know, she just gave it everything, totally drenched, and she played, like, boost the beat, played ahead of the beat, and those are the drummers that I would go and see and feel like, you know, that's the club I want to be a part of. So all those bands, I felt like, you know, I want to join that team. So early 80s, late 70s, those bands were pretty vibrant, and that's really what created the punk scene as I knew it, and at least in Los Angeles where I was.
Are you still friends with anybody? Did you make any sort of lasting relationships with people from there?
Yeah, Keith Morris, I'm still friends with. Mm-hmm. He's my homie forever. He and I used to, and some other friends of ours, had a group of guys. We'd go out one night a week drinking, called the Bud Club. And Keith doesn't drink anymore, but he's going to be my bud forever, you know. And it's when he comes in town, you know, when I lived in New York, he played the Knitting Factory with Midget Handjob, one of his bands, and pulled me up on stage so I could play. And last time he played here in town with his band Off, he announced that I was in the audience and said, you know, I want you to, you know, give some respect. Let's hear some respect for Tim, or for Spitsticks. He's in the house. Of course, everyone's applauding, and I'm kind of trying to shrink in my shorts, you know, like I should have wore a Buy Me a Beer shirt. But then he dedicates the whole show to me. So Keith is my homie forever. Mm. I stay in touch with him. The other people, stay in touch with Philo from Fear. Although I spoke to him for a little while. When I lived in New York, he and his wife would come and stay with us in the city just for a weekend visit. And one weekend, I remember, it was a while back now, but he had come in with his wife and was just spending the weekend, and we were looking in the paper for something to do, and we saw Fear was playing the Continental. Wow. Which is the Continental, it's not a very good club. And so we kind of laughed about it, and the phone rang, and Lee asked me to sit in for the end, like, last three or four songs. So I agreed. I said, sure, I'll sit in. For how much are you going to pay me? You know, and he had owed me a lot of money, so he said, I'll pay you $100, so... So I agreed, and I said, hey, someone wants to talk to you. So I put Philo on, and he talked Philo into doing it. So we ended up having at least the three of us reunion at the Continental that night. So it was sort of an impromptu. We ended up doing like eight songs, and my wife at the time was in the audience, and people were going, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, so it was a surprise reunion show. That was the last time at least the three of us played together.
Mm-hmm. Were you in touch with Durf near the end of his life?
I was, you know, Durfee.
Wait, did you just call him?
I hated his guts when he was kicked out of Fear. Oh. You know, Lee had asked him, you know, not to come back, basically. And we were kind of at that athletic frame of mind at the time. It was like, we got to rehearse 5 nights a week. And Dirk was kind of more of a social butterfly and was really responsible. He's the one who obviously introduced us to Belushi and a lot of things. Dirk was on the scene hanging out on Sunset Strip every night, that's where he lived, he was really responsible for taking us ahead. But none of us really saw that at the time because he wasn't pulling his weight in rehearsals.
Mm.
And so when Lee basically kicked him out of the band, he thought that I hated his guts too.
Oh.
And I had issues with him, but it wasn't what he thought it was. And it wasn't until I did an interview and he read the interview that I was giving him props and realized that I thought he was cool. That I liked his kind of Dean Martin kind of attitude on stage. And he realized that I liked him. So he called me and we rekindled our friendship. And he was sending me some files to produce some of his stuff while I was living in New York. He was living in Los Angeles in Laurel Canyon, working with a friend of his. And those recordings never came to anything, but we stayed in touch. And, you know, until, you know, not too long before he died, he got in a car accident that really kind of took him over the edge. His health kind of wasn't that great to begin with. He had some liver problems.
Mm.
And the car accident kind of made it worse, and that was kind of the coup de grace there for him.
Mm.
But a sweetheart. Dirk was awesome. Dirk was very unappreciated, I think, at the time he was with Fear by at least towards the end of his time with Fear. I don't think he was appreciated until after the fact, at least by me. And then I sort of, in retrospect, looking back, like, you know, Dirk did this, Dirk did that, Dirk did this, and it was kind of going down the list, like, you know, I looked at him like, Dirk's not making a practice overnight, you know,
right,
that sort of thing.
Well, when
it's
you're
the
in
nature
the,
of things.
Yeah, when you're in the middle of it, it's sometimes hard to take a step back and see the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad. Well,
that's what happened with Dirk. I mean,
yeah.
Awesome cat, though.
We have a question from a listener who wanted to know which record did better, the Fear the Record or More Beer?
Fear the Record, I still get royalties on. It actually still sells, you know, as easy as it is to, you know, rip it from YouTube. It actually still sells. And when I lived in New York, Bruce Harrison, who was the indie buyer for Virgin Megastore at the time, had it, like, featured. You walk in the store, and there it is in your face, you know, the CD, along with some other iconic punk records, but it continues to sell, as well as Repo Man soundtracks, another one with Let's Have a War on it that still sells, actually. So.
Right, yeah.
So the record really outsells all the other Fear things. I mean, the More Beer record was done in 2 days, soup to nuts, which I started out being producer, and I sort of put my hands up halfway through it, like, all right, Lee, you take credit for this, because it really went way too fast for me.
Wow.
In spite of, it came out good, it was funny, it was fun doing, but it was like literally 2 days at Cherokee in Hollywood, and that was it. One day of cutting, one day of mixing, done.
Wow.
I mix stuff. All stuff I work on now, I'll spend a week mixing one track.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I can afford it. I have my own studio, my own house, but back then it's, you know, it's a lot for studio time, so we did that record. I think we spent $3,200. $1,600 a day we paid for blockout time at Cherokee, and that's what we did it in. And Ron Gowdy released it. He gave us a package and distribution deal, and it was a great deal for us, you know, but it didn't get the time I would have liked to. The record, we spent a couple weeks rehearsing, just specifically to go in and record those things, knowing that we were going to be in the studio in 2 weeks. So it was a lot more preparation for the first record. And, you know, the first record was engineered kind of by an old school engineer. I would probably do things differently myself. You know, some people say it's too clean or whatever, but it was kind of the tools we had. But I think we had a $60,000 budget to do that record, and studio we recorded at it was pretty expensive. I remember walking in and Rick Springfield was in there, and his dog had just pooped in the studio. So we walk in and check our room out. Like, oh, great. This is where we're cutting our next record.
That's what the $60,000 is for.
that's his girl's writer's dog's poop.
Right. Oh, that's funny. And that's amazing that about how much your budget was for, because it's, you have to come up with a clean sounding record for $60,000. You can't really get the dirty punk.
That studio had a nice new console, and it was a great studio. I remember I spilled beer on it accidentally one time, and caused a lot of heart attacks. And
I'm sure.
I know, it was an awesome console and great gear, and it came out nice, and because the studio was nice, whereas like the Chili Peppers stuff that I cut in Studio 9 for $20 an hour, there's some a cappella singing stuff where you can hear, because I got cables run like, you know, 50 feet out into the hallway to get natural reverb in the hallway.
Right.
You can hear this constant hum, you know, through the whole, you know, a cappella section, you know, it's like, but, you know, it's, people are forgiving. If the thing's alive, then it doesn't matter the quality, really, whereas we really honed and spent a lot of time getting things to sound right. And Gary Lubow, the engineer, producer of that record, was kind of schooled in that quality of sound, too. He wasn't a punker, you know, by any means. He wanted to get classic, clean rock sound. So that's why that record came out the way it did. And for whatever it's worth, I thought we gave good performances, and it sounds good. I think I'm proud of those recordings and the fact that all that stuff got logged in when it did. And of course, like I say, I still get, well, I'm not getting rich on royalties. Early days, it was pretty substantial. Nowadays, you know, it's a nice surprise when I get a little check. It's like, hey, somebody's actually buying this record still.
Right, yeah. I think that it's more, you know, there's a lot of older punk records that kind of are seen more as just a document because the quality, the recording quality is not great. So it's sort of like, oh, well, you know, it's historical and it's this and that. But that record did sound really good, and the drumming was super, you know.
Yeah, I was spending 2 weeks, you know, clean, sober. That was definitely helped putting that down. And being when you're spending that much money in the studio, you tend not to cloud your brain with anything. I mean,
right.
We all like to party in those days, like anyone else. But I think that little window of time, we said, "Okay, let's try and do this," you know, and not waste money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for songs to play on your show. I realized going back, like, wow, it's like listening to Black Flag stuff, or you know, some of the recordings. I was like, man, that was just horrible. People, of course, they couldn't afford decent recording. A lot of bands in those days, but I just think now how cheap it is, you know, with people being able to have home digital studios, that you can spend so much more time getting good sounds now than you could then. It was like people had 16 tracks or 4 tracks, and, you know, and maybe the guy who was a busboy, you know, at the restaurant is now doing sound at their little stage in the back, and now he's qualified to record a record.
Right, yeah.
You know, so the quality, you know, you kind of got to look over the shortcomings sometimes of the sound to look back at some of that stuff, at least I do, and just remember that what it was doing wasn't trying to make a